When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is sponsored by Fall or Dodge in Hell by Neal Stephenson. If you could live forever, if you could cheat death with science and money, well, death would not be pleased. New from Neal Stephenson, the number one New York Times bestselling author of ReamD and Seven Eves, comes the wildly inventive new science fiction thriller Fall or Dodge in Hell. Read Fall or Dodge in Hell by Neal Stephenson on sale now from Morrow, wherever books are sold. This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 317. We're recording on Thursday, June 13th, 2019. I'm Rebecca Shinsky. I'm here with Amanda Nelson while Jeff is out on vacation. And we're coming to you from BookRiot.com.
Are you allowed to take vacations when you're the CEO?
You know, I think everyone needs vacations, Amanda.
Fair. Fine. Whatever. It's fine.
We encourage a culture in which people rest.
Except he's terrible at it. He's probably got his laptop with him right now.
That's true, but he's at least pretending to take a vacation. True.
Now y'all know a thing about Jeff. He's bad at vacation.
Jeff is somewhere with a secret spreadsheet as we record this.
Don't we all, though? We all have secret spreadsheets.
We do, but I don't take them on vacation.
No, same. Nope. No, I don't bring my computer with me. My phone goes in a drawer.
Get that unplug. One of these days, I don't know, maybe when Book Riot is another 8 years older, Jeff will have learned to turn it off. Then again, maybe that's why he's the CEO.
Yep. Could be.
How are you? It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. I am great. It hasn't stopped raining for like a week, so I'm just trudging through, like waiting for that to no longer be the case. I'm surviving.
Yeah, surviving summer, reading some books.
The swamp. I am reading some books. I'm reading a lot of books.
Excellent. Well, before we get into the week's news, lots of juicy things this week, including some things that just occurred this morning before we got ready to record. Why don't you tell me about our first sponsor?
Alrighty. Our first sponsor. I'm doing I don't know what the voice that is. That's like Delilah After Dark. Our first sponsor is Turtles All the Way Down by John Green, which I don't feel like I need to tell you. You know who wrote that book. It's John Green. So in Turtles All the Way Down, 16-year-old Aza had never intended to pursue the mystery of fugitive billionaire Russell Pickett. There's a name for you. Russell Pickett. Does he own several oil rigs? I'm going to guess yes. But there's a $100,000 reward at stake, and her best friend Daisy wants to investigate. So together, they navigate the short distance that separate them from Russell Pickett's son Davis, and begin to investigate the mystery of fugitive billionaire Russell Pickett. Of course, we all know who John Green is. This is his like long-awaited novel after The Fault in Our Stars. He won a bunch of awards for Looking for Alaska and aforementioned Fault in Our Stars. And this new book, Turtles All the Way Down, shares Aza's story with unflinching clarity. It is a novel of love, resilience, and the power of lifelong friendship. That sounds really nice. Thanks, John. So that's Turtles All the Way Down by John Green.
All right. Well, the big news last week was Barnes & Noble reaching an agreement with the hedge fund Elliott Advisors investment firm to be purchased, to go private again, and taken over by James Daunt, who is planning to move to the U.S. to, you know, do what he did for Waterstones here for Barnes & Noble, hopefully give them some new life, point the ship in the right direction once more, all those things that we are certainly hoping will happen for Barnes & Noble. I think we've established that the continuation of Barnes & Noble is good for books and readers and sort of the general state of things. That's the story is getting more interesting this week because it was reported that ReaderLink, another company, has decided to make an offer, has made an offer. No one connected to Barnes & Noble or ReaderLink will comment on this, but Publishers Weekly has a report that ReaderLink is maybe going to create a bidding war here. It is assumed, based on what we know about the Barnes & Noble and Elliott Advisors deal, that ReaderLink would have until the end of June 13th, which is today when we're recording it. So by the time y'all are listening to this, something might have happened to make a new offer. If Barnes & Noble reaches an agreement with someone who's not Elliott Advisors, there's a keep shop provision in the deal that would mean that Barnes & Noble would basically have to pay Elliott Advisors $4 million to break up.
It's for their trouble.
If something happens after June 13th, which again, maybe it will have by the time you hear this, the breakup fee would be $17.5 million in cash. So
why don't I get paid that much when I break up with people? Dating the wrong hedge fund managers, I guess. I date zero hedge fund managers.
You know, there's time, though.
There is.
If you're listening to this and you know an eligible hedge fund manager.
Who lives in Richmond, Virginia, weirdly. That's weird.
The Book Riot podcast is a full service media vehicle, and apparently now we are matchmakers.
Very useful audience, y'all. I love this, because ReaderLink is huge and scary. And I think that this would be a lot more interesting than turning Barnes & Noble into Waterstones. Like, my chaos neutral Dungeons & Dragons chart makes me want this to happen just to see what happens.
Yeah, I want to also watch a bidding war unfold, because it's pretty surprising, given the state of Barnes & Noble over the last few years, that there would be a bidding war for it.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, ReaderLink distributes books to not bookstores. So like, they distribute books to Target and Walmart and warehouse clubs is what this article says, but that means like Costco. And Target and Costco move some frickin' units. Like, they move books. And for that infrastructure to own Barnes & Noble would be like super interesting. What would happen? I don't know.
I think it would be super interesting as well. This whole thing, even if it's just rumors, has been great for Barnes & Noble's stock price.
I bet.
On May 30th, shares were trading at $4.31 a share. They rose to $5.96 on June 6th following the report of Elliott's offer. And then with the report that ReaderLink is going to make a play for the chain, the stock price rose to $6.80 a share. So an increase of 50% in their share price in the last couple of weeks just because of this discussion. I guess by next week, we'll know what's going to happen.
Godspeed, Barnes & Noble.
Good luck, Barnes & Noble. We look forward to hopefully talking about better news soon.
Mm-hmm.
How about our next follow-up?
So this is a further chapter in the Drag Queen Story Hour in Texas situation, where, you know, Drag Queen Story Hour was basically canceled in Austin, right? Like, they stopped doing it for a variety of reasons. And now a progressive church has taken it over, kind of, but they're not. Like, the headline's a bit misleading. Progressive church steps in to host Drag Queen Story Hour in Texas Library, blah blah blah. But they're not hosting it in the church. They're hosting it in the library. They're just closing the rest of the library while it's going on to keep the protesters out.
Yeah, this is a really clever workaround, I think. The group, which is called, the church is called Open Cathedral, and they have rented a conference room in the library to host the event. The library has been very careful to say that allowing the church to use the conference room does not constitute an endorsement of viewpoints expressed by the participants from anyone in the city, that the rental agreement and rental requests are honored on a first come, first serve basis. So they're basically backing off like one step to say, public libraries provide resources to our community on a first come, first serve basis, and the members of this church requested this room, and this is the thing that they're choosing to do with it. The library anticipates protests, and so they have, as you said, closed the rest of the facility during that event. They're going to have a designated area outside to allow for peaceful assembly, and that's anticipated to be coming from the Texas chapter of Mass Resistance, which describes itself as a pro-family activist organization. However, they are labeled as an anti-LGBT hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. So you can do the math on that. Yeah.
I don't know. I was trying to think about whether I would take my kids to this. And like, Drag Queen Story Hour, as it was before it became this huge controversial thing, absolutely I would take them to. But would I take them to a locked door story hour knowing that, like, banana pants hate groups were going to be standing outside? I don't know. I'd like to think that I would, but also I'm a weenie, so, like, maybe I wouldn't, because that's
well,
really
I mean, that becomes, like, a really complex conversation to have with your kids, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You've got these open-minded, lovely children that would have a blast at Drag Queen Story Hour. Like, I'm in this very moment wishing that I could watch your specific children go to Drag Queen Story Hour.
They would love it.
It would be so much fun. But right, if you have to walk them past, like, a protest line of hateful things, and who knows what they would hear or see. Like, you know, of course they're going to hear and see those things in the world at some point, but, like, do you want to have that conversation on a Saturday morning when you're going to the library?
I mean, like, yeah, like, is the, I wouldn't take them to, like, I wouldn't walk them past a Westboro Baptist Church picket line. So, like, would I walk them past? I don't know. It's just complicated.
Yeah. Happily, the church officials weren't expecting a huge response, but they have seen more than 2,000 people flood to the website to express interest in attending. They're anticipating about 150 people will actually attend the news story hour. And they're, you know, confident here that it's about a community that has more diversity than politicians realize. And they're expressing that it's about a world that's changing and people who want to be more loving than people who are saying, be quiet and sit down. So good stuff from Minister Ryan Hart at Open Cathedral. Good job to them. I think, you know, there's also a group, a liberal group called ATX Resistance Action, that's planning a kid-friendly counter-protest at the time of the event to show support as well. So, like, there are, I guess, a couple opportunities and different ways you could go. Like, I kind of think the best case is just a million adults who can handle these complicated things show up to the library in support of this event.
Yeah. Or, like, stand in front of the protesters' line and like, block the view of it so that the kids can't see it when they're walking in. Like, that, I don't know. I'm thinking about this from in my, with my clinic escort brain of, like, what do we do to keep the patients from having to interact or see or hear the protesters? And, like, singing You Are My Sunshine at the top of our voices is a thing that we have to do sometimes. And, like, that would be kind of funny if, like, a chorus of supportive adults just showed up at the picket line and started singing funny kid songs.
Mm.
I don't know.
Or just, like, the whole book from Rent.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, I feel so torn about this, and I don't have kids either, because obviously we want these events to continue and for public libraries to be able to host community groups that reflect the members of their community and that serve them. And when you're talking about 150 people attending an event, like, that's an event that your community wants and wants to support. But it seems like the magic of this particular chapter of Drag Queen Story Hour is probably lost. Mm-hmm. Like, that experience is not going to be, you know, purely the experience of, like, a joyful story hour with people who are drag queens.
And that's
it, has all this
kind of, like, the, not irony, I guess irony of it is that this hate group on their Facebook page says that they're protesting in order to protect the innocence of children. But the thing that would that's going to rob these kids of their innocence is seeing them yelling and, like, making this out to be something it very obviously isn't. Like, it was a magical, fun thing for kids, and now they have turned it into this horrible thing that's going to make kids feel unsafe and afraid and ask questions that they're not ready to hear answers for. You know, like, that, it's their fault, obviously.
Yeah, and I think it puts the Drag Queen Story Hour folks in a really damned if you do, damned if you don't position, because if they back down, then it looks to this other group like they've won. But there are great reasons. There are very good, like, justifications for deciding to cancel this event if they were to decide to do that. But also, you continue to run it, and it's not really the thing they want to be doing. You know, this is not the way you want this event to go. Anyway, that's what's going on there. If you haven't listened, there's also an annotated episode about the history and development of Drag Queen Story Hour with one of the founders. So that's a thing that you can check out too. While we're shaking our fists at people, this morning a story broke on the Daily Beast with receipts like, Tarpley Hitt is the reporter who is breaking the story that emails from Nicholas Sparks, who runs the Epiphany School. It's a Christian academy that he founded in North Carolina about a decade ago. These emails reveal that he has spent quite a while, not only trying to, the headline says trying to ban LGBT clubs and student protests, but like engaging in allegedly some other pretty problematic behaviors. The Academy's former headmaster and CEO, Saul Benjamin, is locked in a legal battle with Nicholas Sparks. He has been locked in this battle for 5 years. He alleges that Sparks displayed a pattern of harassment, racism, and homophobia, and that Nicholas Sparks and members of the school board, the board for this private school, not the public school board, unapologetically marginalized, bullied, and harassed members of the school community whose religious views and or identities did not conform to their religiously driven, bigoted preconceptions.
Just out there with the B word, just putting it out there.
Oh, yeah. Nicholas Sparks rejected the claims in a 29-page declaration to the court, but emails that the Daily Beast has obtained show him repeatedly taking issue with Saul Benjamin's attempts to make the school inclusive to people of all faiths, races, and sexualities. And Nicholas Sparks did not comment for this story. So you can click this link in the show notes. You can read these email exchanges for yourself. You know, this one's tricky because it's a private school and private schools are not subject to the same kinds of non-discrimination, like private entities are not subject to the same kinds of non-discrimination policies that public entities are. So like Nicholas Sparks is completely allowed to have a private Christian school that doesn't have a club for gay kids. So I think the real point here is notifying Nicholas Sparks's, you know, very large fan base that this is the person that they're dealing with or the person that they are supporting. Mm-hmm. If money goes his way, like obviously you and I, and I think a large contingent of people who read Book Riot, would disagree with Sparks's beliefs and ideas here. But in terms of like legality, he hasn't like harassment, obviously, but in terms of the ideas about like not having LGBT clubs, like that's his purview at his own private school.
Yeah, the race stuff, though, I think might be a little bit more tricky because he directly interfered with the headmaster's attempts to diversify the schools racially. And Sparks said, allegedly, you know, asterisk on all this, that the reason why the school didn't have any black students is because they can't do the academic work. Okay. And like using that as your logic to interfere with someone's attempts to recruit more black students to your school. Obviously I'm no lawyer like at all, but I'd sue him. I would. because he went on to, when Benjamin showed up at some event with the president of the local NAACP chapter, Nicholas Sparks told him he had brought disrepute to the school.
Yeah.
So I don't.
When one of these emails, like there's a lot here, and this link really did just show up like 30 minutes before we started recording. So I haven't read through
all of
them. Yeah, the rage is fresh. But one of these emails shows Nicholas Sparks and Saul Benjamin having a disagreement about whether they should have specifically called out, like, you know, specifically said that they respect and don't discriminate against members of the LGBTQ community, or if they should have just left it as Sparks, it looks like in this email, would have preferred as just saying, or other like protected classes. So, like you can still get in trouble, I think, for discriminating against members of any protected group in terms of like who's allowed to come through your doors. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like just saying they can't have a club, I think that's a different situation.
Yeah, and he can hide pretty easily behind religious freedom stuff, mm-hmm. With the clubs, but you can't hide behind that for racial discrimination.
Right.
So, what's he going to do there? I don't know. Like, there's no recourse here for him.
Right.
At least not PR-wise. Legally, who knows what he'll come up with. But
Yeah. And, you know, like, we can only speculate about how the Daily Beast obtained these emails. I'm pretty sure it was not from Nicholas Sparks. And it may be, I would guess at this point, 5 years into this legal battle, Saul Benjamin might not have much hope about how the legal situation is going to go. And if you can't win in the court of, like, actual justice, maybe you can attempt to win in the court of rightness, the court of public opinion. And when this came out on our contributor Slack, someone said, you know, I wonder about how many people in Nicholas Sparks's fan base will really be upset about this. Like, don't their views already pretty closely align with his? But I think, like, I mean, this guy sells millions yeah. and millions of books, and they get turned into popular movies. And most people are not, like, passionately closely following the personal lives of the authors that they read, especially when you're talking about an author who's, like, in every airport bookstore. So I think this is really a move to knock Nicholas Sparks off of his public pedestal. And yeah, I support it.
I agree. Like, I don't think that people who really like A Walk to Remember are going, you know, or whatever, are going to necessarily know who Nicholas Sparks is. Like, once a book becomes hugely popular, it becomes distant from the author, and then once that becomes a movie, it becomes even more distanced from the author. So
right.
You know, I mean, like, if you go to ask somebody who just saw Captain Marvel what they think about, you know, Kelly Sue DeConnick, they're probably gonna be like, who, you know?
Right.
So they might not even know who this dude is. And I don't disagree with the premise of that thought, that, like, his dedicated fans probably align with these values that he obviously has. Because his books are, how to say, his books are really enforce outdated gender roles and have no brown people in them whatsoever. So people who are, like, into that kind of story aren't going to care that he feels these ways about.
Yeah. It's very anything. Like, quote unquote, traditional
yeah.
romance of, with all those, with all the value sorts of things implied, like the sneaky thing here, like the one of the insidious things about, I think, the way Nicholas Sparks's books work is, you know, there's not, like, racism on the page. Mm-hmm. There's no one ranting. There aren't, like, male characters ranting about feminism on the page or, like, women are, you know, too uppity these days or anything. It's just that the characters in the books are very traditional, as you said, like, they follow very traditional gender roles. It's all relatively chaste.
Once they get uppity, they die of cancer.
Right. There's like a lot of sort of implied conventional, like, conservative Christian values without the characters spelling those values out. Like, I have read a couple Nicholas Sparks books, not all of them, but I don't remember any characters, like, you know, pledging abstinence until marriage on the page, but you see a lot of, like, relatively chaste relationships where those values come through. And yeah, I think it's totally possible that, I believe it, that a large chunk of his audience probably shares those beliefs, but I think probably a large chunk of the audience just hasn't even thought about it.
Yeah, like, and, like, this doesn't is the even story. Know who he is. Yeah.
Huh?
Like, doesn't know who he is.
Yeah, or, like, this is the story that we've heard over and over from readers. This Book Riot has talked more about inclusivity and diversity in publishing. Is like, if it's not called to your attention how, like, white and conventional the books you're reading are, and you're not, like, naturally disposed to go looking for ways to be more socially just in your reading, you just haven't even thought about it. And people who are just, like, randomly picking up a book in Target or the airport bookstore are looking for, like, what, well, it's the thing we hear all the time, right? Like, I just want to read a good story. They're looking
for that fits in my backpack.
Right. Like, this nice, I'm just going to take a nice little romance and read it on the beach. And Nicholas Sparks is a known quantity. Like, you know exactly what you're getting if you've read any of his books before. And even if you don't know his name, all the covers look the same. So you can be like, oh, this looks familiar. It's like that other thing that I read. And so I think in that way, like, this is a real attempt, hopefully this story will go big, to, you know, sort of make it less likely for him to continue being successful in this same way, to call more attention to who he is and to what you're supporting when you put money in his pocket.
Yep.
Yeah. It kind of feels like an extension, not extension, but, like, it's tangential to the Me Too stuff of, like, oh, by the way, this author that you've loved turns out to have assaulted women, so maybe you don't want to buy his books anymore.
Yeah.
Kind of stuff.
It's just not surprising.
No.
based on what we know about him already, which is not like all anecdata about how he's like rude to fans at signings and refuses to acknowledge that he writes romance novels. Like, he just doesn't seem like a fun dude. And then you combine that with the ways in which his books are very purposefully shaped to have a particular mm-hmm. narrative. And then this comes out this morning and I'm like, yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. And there's stuff like this environment at the school does not sound good. Mm-mm. According to the piece, all of the tension really began in October of 2013 when Saul Benjamin began to hear reports that students had been asking teachers questions about sexuality. According to Benjamin's complaint, the kids had been gathering to discuss their own identities and orientations. And when word spread of the group, Benjamin said he began to receive complaints about bullying from the students who were gathering. Two of the students that were accused of bullying were sons of the school's administrators. Another was a son of an influential parent and was the vice president of the student senate, and the students, including the student senate vice president, allegedly told their classmates they wanted to start, quote, homocaust.
Hmm. Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So just a lot of gross stuff here mm-hmm. about Nicholas Sparks and what he's participating in. Click the link, read the emails. Let's all go take a shower.
Yeah. Maybe take your Nicholas Sparks books to Goodwill. I don't know. You do you.
Why don't we freshen up with a sponsor?
Okay. It has water implied in the title.
Great.
Okay, so that's me. I'm going to talk about it. It's In at the Deep End. I said that weird. In at the Deep End by Katie Davies. This is as charming as Bridget Jones's Diary, as funny as The Office, and as racy as 50 Shades of Grey. That's so much name dropping right there. That's so many things that you can be familiar with. Charming as Bridget Jones, funny as The Office, and racy as 50 Shades of Grey. Funny as The Office? Okay, I'm suspicious. I'll give it a chance. It's a sexual awakening for Julia, the main character, that is as sexy as it is charming. So this is a book that explores how we come to terms with who we are and what we want. A love letter to modern London, as the author observes her generation with razor-sharp wit tempered with warmth, fresh and funny, but also full of tenderness and wisdom about being young and in love with life. Excuse me. It's sex positive, embraces female sexuality, timely, and doesn't shy away from anything. Perfect for this moment as a time when women are increasingly and more publicly celebrating their sexuality and their right to have it. Kate Davies is a writer and editor of children's books. This is not a children's book, in case you're wondering. She's also a former burlesque dancer. That's interesting. So go check this out. There's nothing in there about the plot, but I feel like you don't need any. 50 Shades of Grey meets Bridget Jones meets The Office. Like, what could that possibly be except, like, really a ride? A ride is what that sounds like. No pun intended. So In at the Deep End by Kate Davies. Go check that out. Thanks for sponsoring us.
Nicholas Sparks would hate that book.
He would. Let's send him some copies. This is my new metric for when I pick romance to read. Would Nicholas Sparks hate this?
It's like glitter bombing, except you send like the filthiest erotic romance you can find to Nicholas Sparks' house.
What if people sent it to the school? Don't do this, y'all. Oh, I'm just saying.
No.
Wouldn't that be funny? If somebody said, or just like a million copies of, I don't know. I'm trying to think of like a really good queer teen. Aristotle and Dante.
I was just thinking that.
You know, some Becky Albertalli. Just send them a bunch of... They probably wouldn't let the kids have them.
Mm-hmm. Or, what is the one where the girl is... the girls fall in love at conversion camp. They made a movie of it. I can't remember.
Cameron Post?
Yes,
The Miseducation of Cameron Post, yes.
Yes. All right. Well. Moving on. We're halfway through the year, and the good folks at Goodreads have dropped some juicy data about the hit books, as they're calling them, of the first half of 2019. And they're actually telling us how they determined it this time.
It's amazing.
So they found the books that have the highest reader anticipation, which they've measured by the number of times a book has been added to want-to-read shelves. Mm. Then they factored in the number of reader reviews as well as the average review for each book published in the U.S. through early June.
Interesting.
Yes. And
no sales data.
Yeah, there's no sales data. But, you know, they're owned by Amazon.
Right.
And Amazon doesn't tell us anything about sales data. But it would be interesting if they factored in sales data. Maybe, you know, Goodreads, I think, does still operate like relatively separately from Amazon. So they're just trying to measure anticipation.
That's a Rocky Horror gif right there.
Which books are people, this is like, which books are people most excited about? Maybe interest rather than intent, like purchasing a book is a different
Well, if action. They're doing the number of reader reviews, then that is people who have.
That's true.
Read it, one assumes. I mean, there is that Goodreads phenomenon where people like review books they haven't read yet by just talking about how excited they are about it. But I guess that would have the same effect. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, so what's number one?
Number one is The Silent Patient by Alex Michaelides.
I've never even heard of that.
It's a psychological mystery.
Oh, that's unsurprising. Okay.
Yeah. Number two is Normal People by Sally Rooney, which I've seen all over Instagram. Mm-hmm. It has a couple different covers. And at this point, I'm like just stubbornly not going to read it because it's been all over Instagram.
Yeah, same. It was this. This was the one that was shortlisted for the Women's Prize, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't get it in time from the library, so I didn't read it. I usually read the long list, but I didn't get it this time. So, I don't know. Maybe it's great.
It probably is great.
I've read one book on the top 10.
Same.
Which one?
Mine was Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid, which is number 3.
Mine was Black Leopard, Red Wolf, which is number 9.
All right. Yeah, other things on the top 10. Number 4 is The Wicked King by Holly Black. Number 5 is An Anonymous Girl by Greer Hendricks and Sarah Pekkanen. 6 is Angie Thomas's On the Come Up, which was her follow-up to The Hate U Give. Number 7 is King of Scars by Leigh Bardugo. 8 is Kate Quinn's The Huntress. 9 is Marlon James's Black Leopard, Red Wolf, as you mentioned. And number 10 is No Exit by Taylor Adams. Lots of women on this list.
And it's not all white.
It's not all white. On the come up, we've got Marlon James. Who else here is?
Although The Huntress is part of that big publishing thing that's happening right now. Books about World War II with women facing away from you on the cover. Yeah. Why? I mean, like, books about World War II, I get. Like, it's a thing people like to read about. Women facing away from you on the cover has been a cover trend for forever. Mm-hmm. Why are they now suddenly combined? Why? Yep.
And right down the screen from that, number 11, Pam Jenoff's The Lost Girls of Paris is set in that same era with, like, it could be the exact same model on the cover facing away in, like, a 1940s style.
She's wearing the same hat.
Yep. They only had one kind of hat.
Just one hat. You get one hat. Ooh, The Bride Test. I didn't get all the way down here to 25.
Yeah, The Bride Test is 28. Queenie by Candace Cardi Williams is on here. Like, interesting mix of genres. 99% Mine by Sally Thorne, I believe, is also a romance. Like, there's you know, it's not one note. It's all right.
The Priory of the Orange Tree. I'm reading through the comments now. Most of the comments are people complaining about how the year is not actually halfway over. Like, no one's actually talking about the book.
Welcome to the internet where everyone is pedantic.
I know. Paige, I'm at the bottom of page one of the comments, and almost all of them are, but it's only June. Yeah, good job, guys.
Like, one person is like, this is not halfway through the year. And then someone else says, when would halfway through the calendar year be then? Just and someone responds, at the end of June, when 6 of the 12 months have passed.
All right. Message number 10 is like an analysis of their methodology, which I appreciate.
Okay.
And then I can't. That's it. Somebody arguing with them. I read a lot of self-pubbed authors. Somebody is upset that there's no self-published books on this list. There will never be self-published books on this list.
Right, and that's not Goodreads' fault.
Yeah, that's not Goodreads' fault. Okay, interesting. I'm surprised at how many of these I haven't heard of. The Lost Roses, number 25. World War II, same hat, facing away. Two women. Two. Why?
You know, maybe more interesting is that there are only 22 comments on this.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, given the size of the Goodreads.
How many users do they have? It's like 10 million, right?
Oh, more than that. I think when they sold, it was something like 25 million registered users. Where did I get 10? But and it, like, in terms of like active daily, you know, regular sign-ins, I'm not sure. We haven't gotten a lot of Goodreads data since good old Amazon bought them.
Okay, what is When All Is Said? This is number 23. Okay, that's a dude. It's a dude facing away from you on the cover. Mm. And I don't think it's World War II, which is why I guess it gets to be a guy. I don't know.
Yeah, that cover looks a little too modern to be World War II.
Winter of the Witch, number 24. Not World War II, also fantasy, but lady facing away from you on the cover. Now that I've seen it, I can't unsee it.
Oh, and Lost Roses, number 25, by Martha Hall Kelly.
World War II.
Yeah, it's the follow-up to The Lilac Girls, which guess when way. That's set.
Yeah. Even on the come-up. On the come-up is like, she's not facing you.
Yeah, but that's a, like, power stance.
Yeah. But couldn't she have power stanced, like, looking at the reader?
We get a side profile of a woman in number 27, My Lovely Wife, by Samantha Downing, and she's holding a knife.
Hmm. Daisy Jones and the Six and Normal People and Anonymous Girl and The Silent Patient all have women on the covers looking at you.
And The Bride Test, the woman's facing forward but looking a little down. Yeah,
this is not relevant anything. Like, it's just something that it bothers me.
I don't know. If you're listening to this and you're getting your master's in English Lit and you're looking for a thesis subject, some analysis of like how where the woman is facing on the cover relates to the tone of the book would be great.
Would like a comparison of that to books where men are facing you or not facing you on the cover, because I think, you know, some of the reason why this happens that we have characters or models on book covers who aren't facing the reader is it's like a Mary Sue thing. And so you can put yourself in the position of that character, which I understand. But do we do that with books about men? Or is it just assumed that, like, men are smart enough to imagine the character's shenanigans without needing to insert themselves into the book? But we don't give women that.
There are very rarely, I think, like, any depictions of male bodies on fiction book covers, now that I'm thinking of it. Like,
I'm not... So 99% Mine by Sally Thorne is number 15, has a man and a woman on it.
Mm-hmm. It's a romance.
Yeah, When All Is Said, number 23, has a like cartoon guy on it. And that's it.
Yeah, but like Harlan Coben's book on this list, no figures on the cover.
Yeah.
Marlon James's book on this list, no figures on the cover. I think Taylor Adams, the author of No Exit, is a man. No figures on the cover of that book.
What's going on here? What is that?
This is very interesting. We're going down a... Going down a path here.
I know.
Well, like, there's not a depiction. There's no depiction of, like, Robert Langdon on the cover of Dan Brown books.
That's true.
Or, I don't know, Bob has read all 20 million Master and Commander books, and those just have boats on the cover.
Yeah, like, but you got Russell Crowe for that, you know? Like, you know that Russell Crowe out there was on a tall ship. So every time anyone thinks about or talks about this book,
you just call up your mental image of Russell Crowe.
I actually 20 don't years know ago. If my mental image of Russell Crowe doing Master and Commander is from Master and Commander or if it's from Les Mis. Like, in my head, the hat he's wearing, that might be from Les Mis.
Oh.
Russell Crowe mashup.
I think my mental Russell Crowe is from the Gladiator era.
That's better. I like that movie.
Are you not entertained?
I am.
Well, that was a surprising jaunt that we took. You know, we should have done all the things that gave us fresh rage at once in this show.
That's true.
Because this next story, this is a study out of the UK. It's from The Guardian this morning. But every year, The Guardian does an analysis of the most popular picture books published in the previous year. So this is an analysis of the top 100 picture books published in 2018. Published in 2018, not just like the bestsellers in 2018. So these are new books published in 2018. And they present, quote, a white and male-dominated world to children and feature very few BAME, which is the UK way of addressing diversity for Black, Asian, and minority ethnic characters. That's sort of their standardized acronym. And these books have become more biased against girls in the past year. This is an in-depth analysis that they do from 100 best-selling illustrated children's books. They use data from Nielsen BookScan. This is the second year that The Guardian and The Observer have carried out this study. So it's a relatively new thing. There's not like a lot of established baseline, but last year established the baseline. And this year they're doing a comparison. 41% of characters were female, while 59% were male. They excluded characters that didn't have clear gender identification, which, you know, sometimes happens with the figures in children's illustrated books. Speaking parts for male characters rose by 19%, and the number of lead roles for male characters increased by 9%. Female lead roles dropped by 7%. There were 38 male villains compared to only 10 female villains, and 6 of the 10 female villains appeared in a single book, Roald Dahl's Revolting Rhymes. 85% of the illustrated human characters were white, 15% were Black, Asian, or minority ethnic. Only 5 of those books featured a minority ethnic character in a lead role, and only 1 book depicted a disabled child. So,
the lack of diversity displayed in the books reflects a lack of diversity among authors and illustrators. Not a single author or illustrator of a best-selling picture book was identified as Black, Asian, or minority ethnic by The Guardian. 2/3 of the best-selling authors and illustrators were male. Wow.
Yeah.
I was just at the library yesterday with my kids, who are 8. So, like, we're out of the picture book phase. They're very solidly into, like, middle grade stuff. And we were kind of rushed, so I was like, you know, just pick something and let's go. And they were both like, ah, help me, because I don't have time. So I was poking around in like new releases, trying to find them a book that they would like, and I could not find a single new release middle grade novel that had a girl on the cover. Not a single one. And this was 4 or 5 shelves worth. So I ended up giving Rhett a book about dragons and Atticus, like a nonfiction book about science, because he's really into sciencey stuff right now. But I gave my kid a fictional beast book because I could not find one with the girl in it. And it is so frustrating. It's especially frustrating to me because the narrative that we hear is like, you know, especially about like YA and picture books, I think especially, is like they're girly, you know, like there's nothing out there for boys to read. And it's just trash. Like that is a trash opinion based on nonsense. And as a parent, it's very frustrating because I can't find anything. I can find plenty of books that represent my children, but I can't find any books that tell them about the world outside of their own experience. And that is so obnoxious to me. And that's my rant.
Yeah, like justified ranting. Like this is a real problem when it's easier and more believable that a book would be about an imaginary creature than about a girl.
And this is something I've heard about picture books before, is that there are more, it was a couple years ago when they did this similar study, that there were more books about talking animals than there were about children of color.
Yes. Yeah. In the U.S., the Children's Book Council something does a study every year where they look at books by and about people of color written for children. And it's always just abominably low numbers proportional to the population, and just abominable in general. And I think that's where that number comes from, about like there are more books with like talking cows in them.
And, you know, they've gotten to the age now, my boys have, where they're starting to ask me things about other cultures, because we live in a really diverse neighborhood on purpose. Their school is very diverse. They have a lot of friends in their class who, you know, like English isn't their first language. And so they'll come asking me questions about Mexico or the Middle East, because these are the places where their friends are from. And of course, you know, as a book nerd, my reaction is like, well, let's go find some books about, you know, that culture at the library. And then I just can't. Like, it's just white boys.
Yeah. So I think we don't have the numbers right now for what's happening in the U.S., but it's probably not very different from these popular children's picture books in the UK, and this goes to add to the pile of data that this is a problem, not just in US publishing, but in, you know, at least Western, Western countries in terms of publishing and privilege. So you can dig into the details of that if you would like. Yeah. Ugh, I know.
And it's not like you can't blame the librarians. It's publishers, you know? Like, yeah. My library is probably doing the best that they can, but if publishers aren't putting them out there, aren't putting out books by women and people of color about children of color and girls, then like, what's my library supposed to do?
Yeah.
And what are parents supposed to do? And I'm pretty, like, I pay attention to this stuff, you know? And if I can't even find a lot of books, and it's not like they don't exist. I'm not trying to, like, erase authors, children's authors of color out there. They do exist. My kids have probably read them all already. You know, like, I find them and I'm immediately like, read this.
Right. I think, like, that's just a great point, that if somebody who literally gets paid to think about books all day and specifically to work, to create work and to do editorial stuff around diverse and inclusive books and publishing ideas, if you can't find a bunch of books about brown people and girls for your kids to read, they're not out there.
Yeah. I mean, there are some, but you know, if your kids read really quickly or are voracious and they're reading in any kind of way, you're going to go through them really fast. And then you end up spending 2 weeks just reading books about white boys, which is fine, you know, whatever. But like, that's not how I would prefer to do things.
Yeah.
Especially when they're asking me questions.
All right, let me tell you about our last sponsor this week, and then we'll end on a nice note. How about that?
Okay.
We are sponsored this week by Bombas, my faves. You don't think about your socks often, or if you're like me, you didn't think about your socks often, but now that I have discovered Bombas, they've been a part of my life for a few years since Bombas has been sponsoring the show. I think about my socks like all the time, and Bombas has raised the bar on what I want from a sock. These socks are so comfortable. They're like super soft. They're all natural cotton, so it really breathes. They have this, like, the design is really cool where there's arch support that, like, there's sort of a honeycomb woven section around the middle of the sock that just gives your foot a nice hug. The toes are seamless, so there's no like weird bunching sensation. And the footbed is cushioned. It's really comfortable, but they're not too thick. They have tons of colors. I have like bright, you know, zany patterns of Bombas. They have a lot of different lengths and styles. You can get your business socks from Bombas. You can get no-show socks to wear in your low-cut sneakers. There's stuff to wear to the gym. They have hiking socks. Like, I have Bombas socks now in my life for just about every occasion, and they are wonderful. Bombas are what feet daydream about. And best of all, for every Bombas purchase you make, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need. You can buy your Bombas at bombas.com/bookriot and get 20% off your first order. That's Bombas, bombas.com/bookriot for 20% off. Bombas.com/bookriot. Make your feet happy.
Business socks.
That's why they call them business socks.
People don't know what we're talking about. I feel like, is that video like so old now that it's out of the cultural?
Oh, from Flight of the Conchords?
Yeah.
I feel like it's the, maybe. We are a little old.
The Business Time song from Flight of the Conchords has a hilarious video.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should go watch it. It might be not safe for work, but it's hilarious.
It's not like
taking out the recycling, feeling sexy. It's so accurate.
Well, let me tell you about our hero of the week.
Hero of the week.
Then we'll get out of here. Simon Vanderpool is a teacher at Harrison Elementary School in Lexington, Kentucky. And he is concerned about a couple of things. He wants to support child literacy and to provide students with the opportunities to interact with male role models. His father was absent. He says he sees a lot of students dealing with not having their dads around or as involved as they should be. And he wanted to do something that would address both of these concerns. So he reached out to a barbershop. It's called Prince Cuts Barbershop in Lexington to start a program called Books and Barbers. And he made this connection because one of the kids in his class, the kid's dad is a barber at this shop. The shop is owned by Amir Shalash, who immediately jumped on board. And the way it works is when kids come in for their haircut, they pick a book that they read out loud to the barber.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
Horrible.
And then after the haircut, the kids get to keep the book that they chose for free, and they get $3 in cash, just like as an incentive. Get your haircut, make some money, bond with a positive male role model.
I feel like my kid, Rhett especially, would like only cut a little bit, and then he'd take his $3 and come back 10 minutes later and be like, only cut a little bit, and then he'd do it again.
How many haircuts can you stretch out reading books over?
And getting paid for it. Right. That's what his concern is.
Yeah. And he's such a ham. Like, I think kids who are hams would really enjoy this too. Like, you get to read out loud to someone. But very cool. Amir Shalash at Prince Cut says that the barbers love it. They're really enjoying it. The community is happy about this and about the chance to give back. The program is only about a month old. Mm-hmm. Many of the books have been given from the International Book Project and public donations. So, you know, they need more books in order to keep this going. If you're interested in supporting books and barbers, you can click the link in the show notes and find out how. And if you happen to live in Lexington, Kentucky, and you want to go do this, you can go to princecuts.com. And customers pay $16, and then $3 of it goes to the child. So
great. They have an Xbox in the barbershop for kids.
Aw, it's a hangout.
Know your audience, my friends. They know they're
Yeah.
audience.
And right now the program does not accept monetary donations, but there's an address in this piece where book donations can be sent. So if you're cleaning off your kids' bookshelves this summer, this is a good place to send them. Good job.
Yeah.
Good job, Simon Vanderpool and Amir Shalash. Good job, Lexington, Kentucky.
Don't say that often.
This is not the first literacy effort that we've seen in barbershops, and I think it's super smart to identify like places you've got to go anyway.
Yeah.
Where you take your kid and then you can meet multiple needs at once.
And now I want there to be like a little free library in my pediatrician's office.
Oh.
You know, they put books out and stuff, but
mm-hmm.
I don't want like my germy kid to touch stuff and then put it back. Right. And like spread their germs everywhere.
You have touched that book and now it's yours.
Yeah, now you keep that forever. Keep it away from me.
On that happy note, thank you for joining me this week, Amanda.
You're welcome. Anytime.
You can find links to all of the stories that we've talked about today at bookriot.com/listen. That will be in the show notes. Thank you to our sponsors. All of the info about them is also in the show notes. And of course, if you want to dive into the nasty world of Nicholas Sparks's emails, You can do that at the Daily Beast link. If you have thoughts, questions, feedback, hit us up, podcast@bookriot.com. We'll talk to you next week.